for Palestinians die of hunger and dehydration as the Israeli regime's genocidal campaign on Gaza enters its 153rd day. South Africa urges the world court to take additional emergency measures against Israel to prevent imminent famine and starvation in Gaza. And the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's targeted Kiryat Shemona Airport in occupied territories in support of the people of Gaza. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. Israel's indiscriminate attacks continue to claim more Palestinian lives more than 5 months into the regime's genocidal campaign on Gaza. At least six people were killed in airstrikes and shootings by Israeli forces targeting civilians in central Gaza. In the west of Gaza City, Israeli forces once again opened fire on civilians waiting for aid trucks, killing at least five and injuring over 20 others. Meanwhile, malnutrition and dehydration continue to wreak havoc on the local population. A 15-year-old teenager and a 72-year-old man died in two different hospitals due to a lack of food and water. Gaza's medical sources say the number of people dying of malnutrition and dehydration in Gaza has surged to 20. More than 30,700 Gazans, most of them women and children, have been killed since the Israeli onslaught started in early October. And joining us for an update from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah earlier was Moti Abu Musabe.
Israeli occupation forces committed at least 9 appalling massacres against the Palestinian civilians across different areas of Gaza Strip over the last 24 hours, claiming the lives of at least 86 Palestinian civilians and injuring 113 others. It's worth mentioning that the Israeli killing machine continues claiming more lives of the Palestinian civilians. Over the last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks against the central area of Gaza Strip, as at least seven Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed, in addition to 10 injuries, after the Israeli occupation forces opened their gunfire towards the Palestinian civilians gathering near Gaza Valley area, located between the central area of Gaza Strip and Gaza City. It's worth mentioning that that area, particularly the northern parts of Al-Nusrat refugee camp and Al-Mughraga neighborhood, witnessed harsh Israeli attacks against that area, including the consecutive and the continuous Israeli airstrikes and the constant Israeli artillery shelling, destroying more horizontal buildings and resulting more devastation in the infrastructure there. And in the meantime, here in Deir al-Balah city, the Israeli occupation forces destroyed another residential buildings after the Israeli warplanes destroyed and leveled to the ground that building. It's located in the south, the southern part of Deir al-Balah city.
South Africa once again asks the International Court of Justice to take additional emergency measures against Israel amid the regime's genocidal campaign on Gaza. South Africa urged the World Court to take measures and stop imminent tragedy and save Gazans from dying of starvation. It also warned about threat of looming all-out famine in the war-ravaged territory. Pretoria urged the World Court to force Israel into taking immediate and effective measures to enable the provisions of desperately needed humanitarian aid into Gaza. Said such measures have to be taken without a new round of hearings because of the extreme urgency of the situation. In a case filed by South Africa in January, the ICJ had ordered Israel to refrain from any acts that could fall under the Genocide Convention. And earlier, we discussed South Africa's call for the ICJ's additional measures to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza with our guests in our news review program. News review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now joining us for the program is Jim Cavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York, and Frank Emspeck, radio producer and political commentator, joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. Frank, I mean, South Africa they got that ruling at the ICJ back in late January, I believe it was the 26th, if I'm not mistaken, that Israel refrained from genocidal acts, a ruling that the regime basically just laughed at. So why expect the ICJ now to push for measures to prevent starvation and famine? I mean, this kind of shows that nations at this point are desperate and really don't know where to turn for action, for answers.
I don't think that's true. I think everybody knows where to turn for action and answers. $14 billion is a start. Unlimited arms sales is the second aspect of it, right? And so you could have serious initiatives on the part of other countries in the world to, say, cut off financial aid, as they did with Iran, but over the nuclear stuff. People didn't seem to have a big problem figuring out what to do, you know, when they wanted to do it. And the ruling classes in these countries said, right, boom, you know. The Dutch took this little baby step saying we're not going to send, spare parts to parts of the Israeli military. Every country in Europe could do that. The United States could do that. So everybody knows where to turn. The question is the political mixture. And the fact of the matter is that, yes, significant sections of the American ruling class, for a variety of different reasons, have decided that Israel is our aircraft carrier in the Middle East. Maybe that's the reason. But the cost is going up. And I think that this also depends on what other countries are prepared to do. And in other countries, the populations are in fury. And again, in the Middle East in particular, these regimes which were able to overcome the Arab Spring may not be able to overcome this. And I think they have to worry about that. But our problem here in the United States, and I want to focus on that, is to figure out how we're going to move this government. Now, if we take the position that nothing that people ever say here makes any sense or can influence politics, well, then I guess there's nothing to do. I have been active for a long time. And in 1968, which is when we had a referendum here in Madison, Wisconsin, not one single member of Congress at that time supported immediate withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. That was what we had on the ballot here. 44% of the population voted for that here. Not a majority, but a huge amount. It was one of the reasons that Johnson gave for withdrawing from the race, presidential race at the time. Well, I think we're in a similar situation. We're at a cusp here. And we're either going to have a more democratic, serious discussion here in this election, or maybe you're right, we're going to go down the drain here. But I think that the key is the United States and people building and making sure there's the political space, because we're not getting the leadership, the political space to push people to say enough is enough. Because I think we cannot do this. You cannot predict world war over Israel as the way to solve the Palestinian problem. Because if somebody, the Chinese or the Russians or somebody else said to the American Navy, we're going to come in whether you like it or not, what does that really mean? So I think it's here on us in the United States to figure out how to have the kind of democratic and popular movement to force the policy changes.
Good stuff, Frank. And Jim, last thoughts with you. I'll put the same question to you, and you can answer it if you want. Take it back to Washington the way Frank did, or go on another tangent. But basically, why is South Africa going back to the ICJ? Why take a thirsty horse back to the same trough that was dry last week, expecting for it not to be dry this week?
Well, South Africa is doing its best. You know, this is a front of battle, and it's good for them to do that. But as Frank said, the ICJ doesn't have enforcement capability. Somebody has to enforce this. And look, I was at Vietnam too. I saw things change in Vietnam from one year to the next. And that's true. But you did not have the same cohorts of wealthy, powerful people around the world in the Western countries who are absolutely committed to saving American imperialism in Vietnam. You have cohorts, wealthy cohorts in the United States and around the world who are absolutely committed to saving Zionism and know that's what's at stake here. So, and the other problem is the people of Gaza don't have time to wait to see what happens in the American election in November. They're over. They're starving and dying of disease. Something has to be done, or they're going to go, and we can sit around and say by 6 months from now or 10 months, oh, look how there are three more congressmen in Congress that may say something against Israel, still be given the money and still be given the arms. I don't see what's going to stop that in the next 10 months. So, and I don't think the Gazan people have time for that. That's the situation that I think we have to take seriously and realize it's a terrible situation. And somebody, and it's under the, now any party that goes, we're not coming in to attack Israel, we're coming in to bring that humanitarian aid. Under the sanction of the ICJ, that's what's going to enforce the ICJ ruling. If nobody does it, then it's never going to be enforced. And the people of Gaza will be expelled and exterminated.
Thank you, gentlemen, both of you, for joining us in the program and your respective takes on this. Mr. Jim Cavanaugh, their political analyst and blogger, joining us out of New York, and Frank Imsbach, radio producer and political commentator, joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Norway says that many countries that have paused financial support for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, are likely to resume funding soon. Norway, a top donor to the UN Agency, says many UNRWA sponsors have agreed funding needs to be resumed. UNRWA says none of the 16 donor countries that had frozen funding have yet to resume it. This, while Iraq and Qatar say they'll give extra funds of $25 million to the agency. UNRWA sacked a dozen of its staff following Israeli claims they took part in the Hamas operation in early October against Israel. Several countries, including the U.S. and U.K., paused funding to the agency following those allegations. The agency has strongly denied the claim, saying Israel has obtained confessions from its staff under torture and duress, and it's warned of deliberate and concerted campaign aimed at ending its operations in Gaza. And earlier, we asked investigative journalist Tony Gosling why funding to UNRWA has been suspended by donor countries in the first place.
The fact is that these were just allegations, and the countries that went along with this, well, look at the main countries, United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Well, who is this along with Israel? It's the Five Eyes intelligence services of the Anglo-Zionist Empire. And so they're not really testing the information that the Israelis have put out about UNRWA and alleged links to the 7th of October. They are simply doing a knee-jerk reaction, which is actually complicit with the genocide. The other countries, France, Holland, Germany, Sweden, Italy, Romania, Estonia, Finland, these are now NATO countries. So we're looking at the Anglo-Zionist countries and NATO being the ones to try to stop food getting through to the Palestinians.
And now Hamas has blasted Israeli expansionist plans for the occupied West Bank. The movement says Israel's plans to build thousands of new settler units near Al-Quds proves regime's intention to bring Palestinian land under its control. The movement added Israel wants to isolate a Palestinian nation by building a network of settlements across occupied territories. Hamas also noted Tel Aviv wants to prevent Palestinians from establishing a state with Al-Quds as its capital. Tel Aviv's advanced plans for building another 3,500 settler units east of Al-Quds. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law, while some 700,000 Israelis live in around 160 such settlements built in occupied Palestinian land. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq has launched a new attack against Israeli targets in occupied territories in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The Iraqi Resistance says it's targeted Kiryat Shemona Airport in north of occupied territories with a drone. Earlier this week, the Resistance targeted Israeli port of Haifa twice, hitting a chemical facility and a power station at its airport using drones. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it will continue these attacks on Israeli targets until the regime stops its campaign of genocide in Gaza. It's also struck major American military bases in both Syria and Iraq amid anger over Washington's support for the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. And the Yemeni army says it's carried out fresh attacks against a U.S. target in the Gulf of Aden.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces carried out an operation against a ship, an American ship, in the Gulf of Aden with a number of appropriate naval missiles, and the targets were hit accurately, thank God, which led to the ship being engulfed in flames.
Yahya Saadi said attacks came after American cargo ship ignored warning calls to stop for inspection. He stressed the operation was in response to earlier airstrikes by the U.S. and U.K. on Yemen, and also in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Yemeni forces have targeted over two dozen Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea since the beginning of the regime's onslaught on Gaza. Sana'a stressed these naval operations will continue until Israel stops its genocide and lifts its siege of the besieged enclave. Tensions are boiling along the southern Lebanese borders. Israel and Hezbollah resistance movement have been engaged in heavy clashes on an almost daily basis. Hezbollah says it's carried out fresh attacks against Israeli military sites in response to the regime's recurrent shelling of civilian areas in southern Lebanon. And earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, for your details.
Well, today, Hezbollah's retaliation for the shelling against civilian areas and the destruction of many civilian houses in the bordering towns and other areas as well. They launched an airstrike, as they called it, by using a kamikaze drone in the area of Mutilli against the base in Mutilli specifically. Of course, the entire area and the whole 5 kilometers beyond the border have transformed into basically a military zone by the Israelis as a result of Hezbollah's operations. Hezbollah also launched its rockets against the bases in Ruwaisat al-Alam, in Qarshuba Hills, as well as the Zabdin post in the Shabah Farms. The Israeli shelling, of course, did not stop in many of the bordering towns and a little bit beyond that. We're talking about Yarun and Yatar, in addition to Dhaira and Marwahin, as well as the surrounding area of the Shaba, which is the Shaba town, which is not occupied in itself. Of course, that is always under constant Israeli shelling.
Iran has strongly condemned a joint statement by the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait regarding the 3 Persian Gulf islands of the Greater and Lesser Tunis and Abu Musa. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani dismissed the two countries' meddlesome allegations, saying they're devoid of any political or legal value. He said the 3 islands are an inseparable and eternal part of Iran, asserting countries' territorial integrity will never be up for negotiations. The 3 islands have historically been part of Iran, proof of which can be found and corroborated by countless historical, legal, and geographical documents. Tehran has repeatedly rejected the UAE's claims over the islands, saying they are an indispensable part of the country and will remain as such. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Washington is in control. Washington wants the Israeli regime's genocide against Palestinians to continue. It just wants to pretend that it is aiding Palestinians while it helps the Zionist regime murder them. Washington clearly sees the airdrops as means to do that. We have taken a look at some of the world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay with us. The Electronic Intifada has covered this story and tells us more. What is being marketed as benevolent assistance amounts to humanitarian aid theater that does nothing to end the systematic and intentional campaign of starvation the Israeli regime and its American and European allies, with the complicity of regional regimes, are waging against Palestinians. Experts and aid officials have made clear that these airdrops are not an effective way to alleviate the starvation of 2.3 million people in Gaza, deliberately caused by the Israeli regime with the full backing of the United States. By participating in these airdrops, Egypt and the United Arab Emirates, but especially Jordan, whose air force is carrying them out, are providing public relations cover for countries directly involved in the Zionist regime's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. The effect, whether intentional or not, is to relieve the Israeli regime and its backers of pressure to lift the total siege that Tel Aviv has imposed on the coastal enclave, with the clear intention of causing maximum suffering and death to as many people as possible. Right now, children in Gaza are being starved at the fastest rate the world has ever seen, said Melanie Ward, the chief executive officer of the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians. It's very simple. It's because the Israeli military won't let it in, Ward told CNN on Thursday, explaining why aid is not reaching the people of Gaza. We could end the starvation tomorrow very simply, if they would just let us have access to people there. But recently, the United States military and Jordan dropped supplies along Gaza's coastline, supposedly to alleviate the rapidly worsening famine there. This comes after the United Kingdom, France and the Netherlands, and the United Arab Emirates, and even Egypt, all staunch allies of the Israeli regime, have already taken part in similar stunts, often facilitated by Jordan. U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, claimed the recent airdrops of over 38,000 meals contribute to ongoing U.S. government efforts to provide life-saving humanitarian assistance to the people in Gaza. According to the United Nations, 576,000 people in Gaza, a quarter of the population, are one step away from famine, and the entire population is in desperate need of food. Meanwhile, satellite imagery shows thousands of aid trucks stuck at the Rafah crossing with Egypt, unable to enter Gaza because the Zionist regime won't allow them in, and Washington refuses to use any of its enormous leverage to compel Tel Aviv to do so, or to end its siege on Gaza. That makes Egypt's participation in these airdrops even more bizarre, since Egypt controls the Rafah land border with Gaza but refuses to exercise its sovereignty and control at the border crossing. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime continues to murder and maim hundreds of people every day with US-made bombs and missiles, including while they're desperately queuing or seeking food from United Nations. Since October, the Biden administration has given the Zionist regime carte blanche to carry out its genocide and deliberate starvation in Gaza with total impunity, near constant delivery of weaponry, even bypassing Congress to greenlight arms deliveries to Israel. Jordan has been airdropping supplies into Gaza since last November. Jordan's King Abdullah has participated in some of the airdrops, as seen in a dramatic 2-minute clip published by the Jordanian royal court. The video, reminiscent of a trailer for a Hollywood action movie, shows the Jordanian monarch commanding an operation to drop packages via parachute. These airdrops are coordinated with the Israeli regime, since no aircraft can enter the airspace over Gaza without explicit Israeli permission, or they risk being shut down. Tel Aviv knows that in practical terms these airdrops will not substantially interfere with its policy of deliberately starving the Palestinian population to death, but it is happy with the propaganda imagery falsely suggesting that people in Gaza are receiving significant assistance. An airdrop operation successfully delivered 160 packages of food and medical supplies to residents of southern Gaza and to the Jordanian Field Hospital in Khan Yunis. COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of Israel's military occupation, bragged recently. Before the airdrops, four unnamed U.S. officials told media outlet Axios that Washington was considering the move as deliveries by land become increasingly difficult, as if some kind of natural force was causing the problem. In reality, the Israeli regime leadership knows that without Washington's supply of weaponry, they would have to halt their genocide in a matter of days. So, if the Biden administration had any real intention of ending the famine and extermination campaign in Gaza, it would use its leverage to command the Zionist regime to allow the aid trucks in immediately and to stop the bombing of the enclave. In addition to preventing all but a handful of aid trucks from entering Gaza, Tel Aviv is allowing bombs of Zionist fanatics to stage rallies, blocking aid trucks carrying vital supplies from entering Gaza. These genocidal racists are encamped in tents and enjoy the protection of the Israeli army. They're even hosting outdoor dance parties.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special.
There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Ladies. Like always, we're here to talk about women's issue. And once more, I have the honor to be your host. Well, this is Asma, and here with me, I have Sister Rehane. Well, actually, she's going to introduce herself pretty much perfectly for you. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to Muslim Ladies.
Thank you very much, Sister Asma. I'm Rehane Paisapal, and I'm happy to be here with our dear listeners. I hope you have a wonderful day today.
Of course we would have. Since it's all ladies, then it's going to be wonderful. Well, just for the record, she is an Islamic researcher, and she works on ladies' issues and whatever that matters to us as ladies generally. So whenever we start talking about women, the one and only topic that is so controversial is hijab, for sure. For Muslim ladies, at least, is the first thing that everybody would bring up, and it has got a lot of details into itself, and it's not just a general topic to open it up. It has got a lot of details, not only in the narrations, but also in the Holy Book of Quran. There are a lot of verses and there are a lot of narrations that could tell us a lot about hijab and the entailing issues. So historically, if we look at it, at the background of hijab, it goes back to long centuries ago. Like if we go back to our own country, like Iran, if we talk about Iran, hijab is not just a matter of Islam bringing it into people's culture. It was a part of people's culture. So it seems that intuitively human beings are more prone to protecting themselves and to shielding themselves from the environment. Let's just go back to that old analogy that says, like, hijab is the kind of shell that's going to protect the pearl. And the pearl is, of course, the lady. So we opened it up like this. Historically speaking, people, and of course women, were prone to having hijab, were interested in wearing hijab. And then little by little, as we went further, as Islam came and we had more of teachings and Islamic narrations, people, or just ladies, do it with much more of knowledge. And they have been educated on that.
Yes, well, hijab, it goes hand in hand with modesty. And women, of course, innately feel that they want to have modesty when they are in society. And the reason that hijab is really bold in Islam is because Islam came and created, somehow it set rules for hijab. Mm-hmm. It gave outlines for hijab, like this is the definition of hijab, and this is how much you must cover up in order to preserve your modesty. And so historically, as you said, women have been prone to covering themselves up and being more modest than men. And that is because of course, women being more beautiful than men, obviously.
Oh, obviously.
Yes,
there's
obviously.
No one to contradict that in here. Well,
yes.
We can say everything based on our own, team. That is, team ladies.
Yes. And so Islam came and created perfection for that covering, that modesty, and gave an outline for women for hijab. Not just for their coverings, the way they cover themselves physically, but also the way they handle themselves and they behave in society towards other men. So hijab is not just about the covering of the physical body. It is also about your mannerism and the way you handle yourself. I guess in other religions, there are also different versions of hijab as well, especially in Abrahamic religions. But the reason that hijab is very bold in Islam, and Islam is known for the hijab instead of other religions, is because of the parameters that Islam has set.
There are some foundations for that. There are some set of rules, and those rules, I guess, they exist in other religions as well. But then in Islam, it has been more detailed. They have went into different details of it. It's not just like it's strictly being imposed on women. No, it's the part of the religion, just like the other parts, like the prayings, like every other part in a religion, it has been more detailed.
Exactly. And not just more detailed, but obviously in Islam, women are supposed to cover themselves more than other religions. So maybe in Christianity, wearing a blouse, a long sleeve blouse, mm-hmm. and a long skirt would be considered as being modest.
Because when Islam came, it actually completed all the other religions.
Exactly.
That's why we have much more of details, and then the covering part have got all the simple aspects that a woman should go through. So it considers everything about a woman, and that's why hijab is so bold in our religion. So I guess this was a good introduction. Let's go for a short break, and then we'd come to pursue the rest. Yes, hijab has always been the topic whenever we start talking about women, especially Muslim ladies, and it has got a lot of details into itself, and it encompasses much more topics than just covering yourself. So this is Muslim Lady. Sister Rehana and I were talking about hijab, obviously, and we talked about it historically. We talked about why in Islam it's so much emphasized, and hijab is part of whatever that is focused to talk about. And then right now, let's come to our modern day. Well, as a mother, since you're a mother and you have a baby, when she grows older, do you think there are any specific ways that we could teach our daughters about hijab so that they themselves would love to go for it and don't look at it as a strict rule?
Well, I personally am more of a traditional person, and
same in here.
Yeah, so maybe the way that I would approach it, like maybe some other people would say that I am being a bit too strict. But I think the way that I would go about it is that, first of all, the fundamental thing that I would tell her is that, well, we are free to choose our own religion. So now that you've grown up and you've grown older, you understand things about life now. You can research about other religions, and if you come to the same conclusion as us, that Islam is the best religion, and you accept that, then you have to accept everything else that comes with it. So it's
exactly.
Not like a buffet that you can choose, pick and choose whatever you want out of the religion. You can say, oh, I want to say my prayers, but I don't want to fast.
Mm. Selectively, just whatever you like, you go for it. Whatever you don't like, you just ignore.
Exactly.
And put it aside.
Exactly. It's a whole package. When you accept Islam as the rightful religion, then you have to accept everything else that comes with it. If Allah tells you to do something, you do it. No questions asked.
Then why accepting this for women is such a difficult task? Why in modern days, you of course see it among your relatives, friends, colleagues, I don't know, wherever you go and work, your co-workers. Why is it so difficult to come to accept this very basic thing?
Well, it's just like any other aspect of religion, really. Simply talking about it, it's very easy to say that we have to accept everything, but the things in religion, they take practice, and you have to, like the Prophet said, it's like the great jihad, Jihad Akbar. So it's like you have to fight with your own demons, you have to fight with yourself, with your desires.
Like it's a battlefield inside of you.
Exactly.
And you have to overcome it.
Exactly. So maybe waking up for Fajr, for morning prayers, is difficult for me.
Even fasting is difficult.
Exactly. Everything is difficult. You just have to, it's an It's an inner battle where you have to somehow believe that you can finally overcome it. Even if you don't observe the hijab fully and you know that, you have to be hopeful that in the future you will find the strength in yourself to observe it fully, maybe in the future.
And education, of course, would play a great role, I suppose.
Of course,
schools, but from the very first step when children, and specifically girls, of course, are starting to get into educational system, I guess it's the best way to prepare them for accepting all these things.
Exactly, exactly. So hijab has to start from a young age. Like, you have to help your daughters practice wearing the hijab before it's obligatory for them.
Yeah, and since we are mothers of the new generations, I guess the mothers are the mirror. You cannot impose something on your children. You cannot expect them to believe in something you yourself do not believe in it. Like, for example, a mother loves her daughter to be this paragon of beauty, and at the same time expect her to be all virtuous, modest, and all this stuff, yet she has not provided a good example for her. Like, she herself has not been a perfect example, and she has never told her about the major figures and characters in our Islamic heritage, like Sayyida Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, or the other women, the great women we have in our Islamic heritage. So we cannot expect our new generations to be perfect at these things without providing them with the elementary stuff.
Exactly, exactly. That is completely true. And besides that, of course, the next step would be to explain to them, to explain to our daughters as best as we can, the philosophy behind hijab.
Exactly.
The reasons why it's important and necessary to wear hijab in society.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Another thing that makes it difficult for the younger generation to observe the hijab when they grow a bit older, I think, is related to the environment, of course. Girls are bombarded every day on the internet or in society with the fashion industry, maybe showing images of their standard of beauty.
All these commercials, all trying to make believe that a woman is just a doll. If you're not according to the rules that they have set for you, if you're not according to every single program they would plan for you for your future, then you're not a perfect lady. Like, if you don't have this perfect shape that is based on, you know, a lot of surgeries and whatsoever, and it takes away your femininity and it gives you only the materialism that they wish for a woman to have, then you're not a part of their group, and you're excluded from the entire female league, let's say.
Exactly. And in these advertisements, not covering yourself up and like nudity, things like that are encouraged, and these are shown as values. So the less you cover yourself, the more valued you are, the more glamorous they show you to be. So
And the more of a perfect woman they would call you.
Exactly. So that is also a huge
obstacle, I guess.
Obstacle. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's a great obstacle. That's a huge obstacle because, you know, for teenagers, it's going to set their future horizon. You know, when they are going to grow up like this with these images in their brain, then obviously they're going to think like, okay, this is the ideal and I should get to this point. And other than that, otherwise, I'm not going to be called a perfect lady. Exactly. And they forget about the virtues and all the things that a human being must have, not a woman or a man. It's not the matter of being a male or a female as much as it is the matter of being a perfect human being. So thank you, sister. I guess this was just the foundation for the coming episodes. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The Limelight.
Attorneys for Donald Trump and his co-defendants have made their final arguments to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia racketeering case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Whether Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis should be removed from the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants is now up to the Fulton County judge overseeing the matter, who said he would make a decision within the next 2 weeks. At a three-hour proceeding before Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, attorneys for each side presented legal arguments for and against disqualifying Fannie Willis from the case over her romantic relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. It capped a series of extraordinary hearings following allegations from Michael Roman, a Republican operative charged along with Donald Trump, that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade had an improper romantic relationship and that the district attorney financially benefited from this. Donald Trump and seven others joined Roman's effort to disqualify Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade and her office from prosecuting the racketeering case against them and are seeking to have the charges against them dismissed. Prosecutors and defense attorneys gathered in Atlanta courtroom to present their closing arguments to Judge Scott McAfee. Nathan Wade attended the hearing while Fannie Willis sat at the prosecution's table to watch Adam Abate, who works in her office, give his presentation. The judge did not issue a decision from the bench, saying he has several legal issues to sort through and factual determinations to make before issuing a ruling. If this court allows this kind of behavior to go on and allows district attorneys across the state By its order to engage in these kinds of activities, the entire public confidence in the system will be shot and the integrity of the system will be undermined, said John Merchant, a defense attorney representing Michael Roman, who opened the arguments for the defendants. Adam Abate said there had been absolutely no evidence that the district attorney has benefited at all or would benefit in the future from the prosecution of the case. Michael Roman claimed that the relationship between Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis began before she hired him as special prosecutor in the case against Donald Trump in early November 2021. The two admitted in a court filing that they did have a personal relationship but said it started in 2022. Both Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade testified during evidentiary hearings last month and divulged personal details about their relationship, financial affairs and travels to places like Napa Valley, Belize and Aruba. During several hours on the witness stand, Fannie Willis forcefully defended herself from accusations she acted improperly and financially benefited from Nathan Wade's hiring. Defense attorneys claimed that Nathan Wade paid for hotel rooms, cruises and getaways, though both prosecutors said they split the costs associated with their travels. Fannie Willis said she reimbursed Nathan Wade in cash. To demonstrate that Fannie Willis typically used cash to cover expenses, on Tuesday prosecutors filed an affidavit from Stan Brody, who worked at a winery in Napa that she and Wade visited last year. Brody asserted that Fannie Willis paid $400 in cash. The district attorney had accused Ashley Merchant, Michael Roman's attorney, of spreading lies and salacious rumors. "You've been intrusive into people's personal lives," Fannie Willis said during her testimony on 16th of February. "You're confused. You think I'm on trial here. These people are on trial for trying to steal an election in 2020. I'm certainly not on trial, no matter how hard you try to put me on trial." CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump's attorneys on Friday, 1st of March, sought to delay one of his criminal trials until after the November election and disqualified the district attorney prosecuting another case against the former president in a split screen that underscored how all of Donald Trump's criminal cases can't help but overlap. In Florida, Trump's attorneys told Judge Eileen Cannon his Mar-a-Lago classified documents case should wait until after the 2024 presidential election. At roughly the same time in Georgia, attorneys for Donald Trump and his co-defendants made their final argument to Judge Scott McAfee in a bid to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in the Georgia racketeering case over her relationship with Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. Neither judge made the decision on Friday, 1st of March, but both hearings could have a significant impact on when or whether Donald Trump will face trial in each of these two cases. Trump's legal calendar remains a jumble of pre-trial legal motions, with three of the four trials still in limbo. In addition to Florida and Georgia, special counsel Jack Smith's election subversion case in Washington remains on hold, with the Supreme Court set to hear arguments on Donald Trump's presidential immunity claims next month. The only case that appears set is Donald Trump's New York criminal trial. That will begin on 25th of March, which Trump's attorney said was a firm date in court on Friday, 1st of March. Meanwhile, a parade of defense attorneys in the Fulton County racketeering case argued that Fannie Willis should be disqualified, stating that she lied about her relationship with Nathan Wade and received benefits from him in the form of trips. Friday's hearing marked the final arguments in the case before Judge Scott McAfee rules on whether to disqualify Fannie Willis after several weeks of testimony that included Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis both taking the stand. The Washington Post has also covered the same story. The judge in the Georgia election interference case against former President Donald Trump and his allies said on Friday, 1st of March, he plans to issue a decision within 2 weeks on whether Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis should be disqualified and charges dismissed because of her romance and international travel with lead prosecutor Nathan Wade. Over more than 3 hours of closing arguments on Friday, 1st of March, prosecutors and defense lawyers presented two starkly opposing views on whether Fannie Willis's office should be removed from the case. Defense lawyers argued that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade created a conflict of interest by not disclosing their relationship or travel expenditures. The prosecution argued that the defense never proved their central allegations that Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade began dating before she hired him in November of 2021, and that she allowed him to pay for travel that they shared. The salacious accusations have taken the Georgia case far off course since they emerged in a January pleading from one of Donald Trump's co-defendants, delaying proceedings for weeks and now threatening to fully derail the prosecution as the spotlight turns to Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee as he decides what to do. The controversy has attracted a national audience because of its potential impact on the 2024 presidential election, with fresh uncertainty on whether a trial will begin before November and what would happen to the case overall if Donald Trump is elected the President of the United States. It is the second of 4 ongoing prosecutions against Trump facing delays against the backdrop of the fall election. The federal election interference case in Washington is awaiting an April Supreme Court review of a claim of immunity.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.